Hi, I'm Steve Hadley, Chair of the Federation of Pioneer Specialists, and you're listening to the FPS Podcast. Coming up is my conversation with Jim DeWale, high-profile engineer and prominent leader within Keller, the world's largest ground engineering company. First up, a message from our sponsor.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
For those familiar with the UK piling industry, today's guest will need very little introduction. Jim DeWale has been one of the most prominent players in the UK foundation market for nearly 30 years. In the last few years, he's gone global. As a Group Strategy Director and President of Europe for Keller, Jim's well placed to give us an insight into issues affecting the industry around the world. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Hello, Steve. Very well. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Been a while since we met up. Obviously, good friends through your work with the Federation of Pioneer Specialists and during your time developing the ICE specification for piling and embedded retaining walls, which you were chair of the committee for, I believe, or lead author. What was your title in that particular document?
Yeah, so I headed up the various committees that then contributed to all of those chapters that you'll be familiar with. We wrote the third edition, and that was published at the end of 2016 in December. I don't know if you got one for Christmas. Did you, Steve?
I'm holding one right now.
Very good. As
a diligent podcast host, I thought it was best that I had a look at the book and refresh my memory. Also, and I think that point the listeners towards this, there's an excellent presentation online as well from Tony Suckling and Pete Ingram, who's from Arup. That was done for the BGA. You've probably done very similar things yourself, Jim, and maybe you've got your own YouTube channel with various different lectures.
Well, funny enough, it's quite timely, really, in the sense that the ICE contacted me only last week, and I've written a blog to sort of promote the use of the third edition, because it's quite a tomb of work, and of course it does build on the previous two revisions. It's been going since the 1980s. And, you know, what we are really interested in people doing is using it to make sure that they learn the lessons of all those people that have gone before. And, of course, a lot of people do end up reading the book once there's been a problem to try and solve a solution on site. And I would just wish that they would read it before the problem occurred.
Solve the solution or protect their contractual position, perhaps.
Yeah. Because basically it took a year to write, and there were something like 35 contributors to it. But it's, for me, a fantastic example of collaboration, really, between the geotechnical professionals who all gave up their time during that year for free. I guess there were quite a few favours had to be called in.
Well, you can be very persuasive, that's for sure, and it's an important skill to have. And I think you mentioned the word collaboration there. It's important to point out that it's not just contractors, piling contractors, that were involved in the preparation of that document. It also is structural engineers and geotechnical engineers as well. And I think that is key.
Yeah, there were 27
clients.
27
well,
different companies involved or organisations. Universities as well, as you say, clients, HS2, Network Rail, Highways England. Yeah, there's lots of different interested stakeholders.
When I was watching the presentation, one thing I didn't realise is that the first ICE specification for piling was sort of an evolution of something that the FPS had been doing in the 60s and 70s. I've never seen that document. I don't know if any still exist, but good to know that the FPS were pushing standards high back in that period, and it's evolved and been adopted by the ICE as well. So you mentioned there about the Eurocode. So that was one crucial element in terms of the need for this document. What other reasons were there to produce this? Because I think it'd been 10 years prior to that, since we'd had an edition, the second edition.
Yeah, well, the first part of the specification talks about how you would manage, organise geotechnical works on a site. And it had been written at a time when, I guess it was written by engineers for engineers, so it did rather major on the ICE terms and conditions. And so we spent quite a bit of time rewriting that so that it was relevant for all forms of contract, and thought quite carefully about the hierarchy between the documents and also how the parties could use that hierarchy to best define what they really wanted to achieve. And the other features of it were we introduced a couple of additional chapters, one on micropiling and the other one on helical piles. And the helical piles was a particular request of Network Rail, because, of course, they've become quite common, particularly for lightweight structures like signals and platform extensions and the like.
Yeah, and I believe the KCFA was also an emerging technology that hadn't been captured in the second edition as well, and I think there was reference to polymers, drilling fluids, that there wasn't quite as much content, and obviously that sort of technology has come on a lot in the last decade. Traditionally, there's been more use of a bentonite, whereas polymers hadn't seen a great deal of use in the UK.
Yeah.
And the ICE specification, obviously, it's used predominantly in the UK. Have you seen its use across the many different countries that you're involved with now?
Yeah, you get to see it in use in places like Hong Kong and Malaysia, and places that have really looked to British standards in the past to set their own control regime. So you do see it there. I think also that in this day and age where information is shared much more readily between people, you see snippets of the specification appearing in other parts of the world. And, you know, I see a lot of that sort of thing, that sort of sharing going on in things like my work with the EFFC and the DFI.
Well, the DFI, we've not really spoken much about before on the podcast. Of course, the EFFC, we had the pleasure of being joined by your colleague, Andy Corbler, and there's a fantastic episode available for listeners to hear about the good work that he's doing there within Europe. But could you just explain a little bit more about the DFI?
So the DFI is a global organisation that brings together not just geotechnical contractors, but people who are more widely interested in geotechnics. So it does include consultants and clients and academics. And you can join the DFI as an organisation, but you can also join it as an individual. So it's quite a broad church in that sense, and I think is a useful add to other trade bodies like the EFFC, like the drilled shaft contractors in the US, the pile driving contractors association in the US, and they can work hand in hand and bring people like the consultants, people like the clients into the discussion, into the debate. And so it's quite useful to have that organisation to tap into when we're talking about particular issues that relate to geotechnical contracting.
Yeah, I noticed they had a huge amount of technical working groups on there, lots of different topics that they were being discussed. One of the things that the FPS have been most proud of in the past is their work on working platforms and the working platform certificate. So if you rewind sort of 20 years, you'd be taking pioneer rigs to site that quite often had no working platform at all. Certainly not one that had been designed, not one where people were really taking responsibility for what was being put down. There might be some material, some old demolition rubble that's chucked on the surface and tracked in with an excavator. But things have massively improved, which has dramatically had a positive effect for our people working on the site, the plant and potential consequences in terms of that going over. And it's terrific to see that people are able to take that lead around the world. Where would you say we are now around the world? You work in all these different markets as at Keller. Where is the integration of that sort of policy in Africa, in America, in Asia? Where are the areas that are perhaps the most developed and others that have got a lot of work to do?
Well, I mean, it might seem quite straightforward to us in the FPS now, because it is around about 20 years since we came up with this notion of the Working Platform Certificate. It's been in place for so long. But the steps that we took in 2000, it's a period about 2000 to 2004, are still relevant to those markets that you've mentioned. And we were lucky because we had a strong federation and the members, although it took some time, we did have some discussion about it, but we did eventually agree to follow the scheme. But we also had the HSE, who were very keen to support and enforce the approach. And not many countries have either a very strong federation or something equivalent to the HSE. So we had a lot of sort of positive forces pushing us in the right direction. And I've been involved and active in promoting the elements of a working platform scheme across Europe, in Australia and in North America for some time. With a variety of success, probably, it has to be said.
Okay.
There are four elements, I suppose, to the working platform scheme as we see it, and that's that you need to have good rig-bearing pressure information. You need to be able to design your platform. And if you remember, we did quite a bit of work with the BRE to come up with a solution.
Indeed.
We then need to have some form of certified installation. That's the certificate. And then lastly, the piece around maintaining the platform. How do we keep checks and balances on the platform going forwards? In some jurisdictions, there are issues around responsibility and liability, well, as indeed there was in the UK, and people are a bit nervous about that. In other parts of the world, they don't have rig-bearing pressures, believe it or not. Clearly, okay. The manufacturers for new equipment tend to provide that, but you mentioned working in Africa. If you're using very old equipment, then you're not going to have rig-bearing pressure available to you. And there's quite a lot of discussion around platform design and the fact that some people think that the current methods produce a very conservative approach. So there are quite a number of obstacles to getting a platform certificate system or process up and running. But in December 2019, we finished the EFFC DFI guide to improving working platforms, which I hope will sort of be a spur to continued progress in this area. In fact, in the US, they've just published something like the FPS approach, and that was driven by the Association of Drilled Shaft Contractors and the Pile Driving Contractors Association. Technically, it's very sound. Whether commercially they can make it stack up or not, we shall see. But let's hope they can get it to bite. Because one of the best things I think that we did in the UK was that the FPS came together and decided that the members would make it a mandatory requirement that they would follow the Working Platform Certificate. And you all know, Steve, that's actually audited as part of the FPS audit every couple of years. So that was a really positive step. But we're some way from that in most parts of the world. But like you said, we are making progress globally. People do recognise the need for a safe platform, and they know also that it isn't just for the geotechnical works or piling works. The platform exists for other users of the site as well. So we are making steady progress, but I think that the FPS is still a beacon of best practice in this regard.
Well, and we'd like that to continue to be the case, but we'll always share those practices around the world. There is material out there that the FPS have got a workshop coming up with your old mate, Derek Egan, ex of Keller, now Remedy Geotechnics. And he'll be explaining to not just FPS members, but other people in the industry, how best to calculate bearing pressures, because obviously it's it's not simply dividing the weight of the rig by the track size. There's so many other things that come into it: extraction forces, pull down forces, handling forces. All of those things need to be accounted for when you're coming up with bearing pressures. In terms of the conservative nature of the approach, there are other approaches out there. So I know that Tensar uses slightly different calculation methods to the BRE method. And I'm sure that at some point that will be acknowledged within a future revision of the BRE document. I'm not sure whether that is currently on the table. I guess it won't be too long. I'll just come back to where we were talking there about the accountability side of it. So I'm interested to know if there's not a HSE within America or within Australia, how are safety, you know, serious safety issues dealt with in those countries?
Well, there are equivalents. So, for example, in the US, they have OSHA, but they're not so active in terms of going out to the sites and physically inspecting. You might also use your relationship with the unions. The unions probably, arguably, have a stronger part to play in terms of enforcing health and safety on sites. But just like the FPS engaging with the HSE, sometimes there's some reluctance in doing that. Sometimes there's a reluctance in engaging with a union if you're an employer to particularly single out HSE and platforms and the like. But there's also, as you know, when it comes to implementing a platform on site, there are a number of people who are going to be interested. There'll be the client who's going to have to pay for it ultimately. There'll be the designer, lead designer, who might think that they're going to attract some liability for the geotechnical design of the platform, perhaps. But they're certainly going to be involved in specifying the type of foundation, which is then going to influence the equipment that's going to be required to install it. There's the principal contractor, or the general contractor, as they call them in the US, the GC. And ordinarily, that body is the one that is responsible for the temporary works coordination. And it's that requirement, which, funnily enough, in the UK, came out of CDM regulation, if you remember that.
Yeah.
Which is back in the 90s, which was originally from a European directive. And the requirement to coordinate the temporary works is the thing that drives, actually, the platform certificate, because all we are doing is asking, in our case, for the principal contractor to confirm that he has made sure that that piece of temporary works, which is the platform, you can view it as a piece of scaffolding if you would, if you wished. I mean, you wouldn't go onto a piece of scaffolding that was completely undesigned. And we say that the temporary platform, piling platform, is analogous to that. And all our platform certificate does is it says that the principal contractor has carried out their obligations as the temporary works coordinator and made sure that bit of work has been done. And there are similar bits of legislation in these other countries around the world. And sometimes people don't know they exist. So some of it is actually all about raising awareness.
Well, for me as a piling contractor, and I think I speak for most of us, it's quite an easy sell, because if we get a good platform, obviously, most importantly, it helps keep our people safe, but it also helps with productivity, which ultimately is doing our clients a favour as well. So I think there's something in it for everybody to make sure platforms are designed, installed and maintained properly. We've explored a little bit of the world there. You must have had quite a varied experience over the last, what is it now, sort of 12 months since COVID and the response to that. Some countries have been far more successful than others in dealing that, but then that's probably also reflected in how they've continued their business. So in the UK, of course, we've carried on with construction almost unaffected, really, in terms of productivity levels. Been a little bit down. I think our trade's been down by about 20%. But there'll be probably other nations around the world that have just shut down construction completely. I'd be interested to know what you've found in your different nations, Jim.
Yeah, it has been quite marked. When the pandemic first struck, February, March of last year, we as a business were quite concerned that, of course, everything would be stopped. We were quite worried that our customers, which tend to be general contractors, principal contractors, would hold on to the cash and not pay us. Possibly that would be reflected in their clients' behaviour. And that hasn't happened. In the main, most countries have continued on with construction. Most customers and clients have been very good in terms of continuing the payment of cash and the flow of funds through the supply chain. I think there's been a real effort actually to continue to do that. So fortunately, we've been quite successful in navigating our way through the impact of COVID. I think, though, there will be a contraction in the general economy. There will be an economic impact, and we have seen that towards the back end of 2020, and we think that that will continue through until 2021. But we've been lucky enough to be present in some fairly significant infrastructure projects around the world, and it's the infrastructure market that's going quite strongly, and we think will continue to be supported as governments use that as a vehicle to pump prime the economy coming out. So it's a bit of a blend, like these things always are. And if you're fortunate enough to be across sectors, then that protects the business to a degree. There are some other notable sectors like distribution. You can imagine distribution is going well at the moment, and we can't build data centers quick enough.
I've had plenty of inquiries. Yeah, Amazon warehouses and data centers are the two things that I've had more inquiries of in the last 12 months than anything. I always come onto this podcast largely with a UK focus, obviously being based here and the FPS being a UK organisation. I think at this point, I'd like to say thank you to the listeners around the world, because over a quarter of our listeners are from overseas, partly, I think, driven by having Andy on in one of the earlier episodes. So hello to you. Please do get in touch if you've got any questions for me or for the guests, and thank you for your continued support. Let's park HS2 for one moment, because I want to come back to that in a bit more detail in a bit. But what other countries do you see as really growing nations for your business in the next decade?
Well, I think that the traditional markets that we operate in still have a lot of headroom. We only have across the world, in the markets where we operate, something like 10 to 15% of market share. So there's still a lot of headroom for our business to grow into. And as well as trying to seek out, you know, emerging economies and emerging markets, we also need to consider those places where we're already present. And in fact, as a business model, it's always easier to build out something that you're familiar with, where you already have a client base, but perhaps can introduce new techniques or new products to. And so building our businesses where we already exist is still quite a high priority for us. And making sure we then bring to bear what we have in the rest of the group in those local markets, because our business is still a very local one. People buy construction locally, and our customers act very regionally. And you'll know that, Steve. Even in the UK, you might have a national contractor, but you will have to concentrate on the regions in which they operate if you're going to be truly successful. You don't very often find people are buying nationally. They like to really stick in the region that they're familiar with. And of course, for us, for the geotechnical world, there's also the question of ground conditions. And, you know, geotechnical engineering, I think, will always need some local experience, in my view. You might have some elements of engineering, like structural design or something like that, that can be done from anywhere in the world. And it could even be automated more and more. But dealing with the ground needs some experience of the local conditions. And that means you need to be there physically experiencing it.
So how does that affect your growth strategy then? Do you tend to just try and grow organically and bring in the skills from different products around the world? Or would you go, right, let's acquire this business in, let's say, South Africa that does a slightly different technique? Maybe there's not one answer to that, but what have you tended to do?
Well, I spend a lot of my time thinking about how we remain focused in the local markets, but then also getting the best from being a larger global organisation. And so that might mean in one region where we have a particular product or technique. So, for example, dry soil mixing, which came out of the Scandinavian countries, Sweden in particular. So if we acquire a dry soil mixing company, can we then use that product and bring it to bear in other parts of the world? So that's one way we can share sort of global knowledge. And then, and to take your point, you might also find that you've got some gaps in your market coverage. So in the US, as an example, you might find you're underrepresented in one of the states there. So you might acquire a company to bolster your regional footprint, or in the case of the Swedish example, you might acquire a company because of its product strength or because of its technical capability. So there's quite often different rationale, but it's always something to do with the local market, and then it's always something to do with how you blend that with the global capacity of the company.
Jim, from the start of this year, we've been living in slightly different world in terms of post-Brexit. You cover all of Europe. How has that affected the work that you're doing in Europe and in the UK in terms of resourcing levels? It must have presented quite a few challenges for you.
Yeah, on a personal note, it makes our conversations in Europe that bit more interesting, particularly since we've sent them a UK variant of the coronavirus as well. So, you know, following Brexit and the virus, we're really popular in Europe, as you could imagine.
There was some gentle ribbon at the last EFFC event, I must admit.
I bet.
It's good to see that they haven't chucked us out of that particular organisation. I think possibly because the secretariat's based in Bromley.
That could be. But also, you know, the UK is very, very well represented on the EFFC as well. I think the experiences of the FPS are quite valuable to the EFFC. And it was Peter Thornton, possibly who had the idea of setting up the EFFC. I apologise to anybody that I might have offended there, but he was certainly one of the founders, or four of them. So, so in terms of the impact of Brexit on the UK construction or geotechnical sector, I suspect there is some economic impact in terms of, you know, the general market. But one of the things that I have seen is graduates are arguably less willing to come and work here. I've certainly had that experience myself, where I've offered job roles to graduates, European graduates, and they've said that they don't feel particularly welcome in the UK, which is a sad state of affairs. But we also need to work through the rules on immigration, because sometimes Keller will bring expertise from Europe to work on a project, especially if it involves a product that's not routinely used in the UK. Something like very deep jet grouting. It's a very uncommon solution in the UK. And so we need to rely upon expertise to come and deliver those sorts of solutions. And so the new immigration rules might actually prevent some of that happening. And in fact, as things stand at the moment, we as a company have yet to identify a way where we can work around it. And to my mind, that's a bit of a shame, because as a country, in fact, we lose out on those people's expertise and possible solutions that are not always available to us. And you might say that that's a good thing, because you'll train up British workers on that particular technique and to carry out that sort of work. But the tasks I'm thinking about are very niche, and perhaps you might only do once every 3 or 4 years. And so you just wouldn't have the opportunity to train people in them. So, you know, the rules at the moment are that you need to be in an eligible occupation, you need to have an A-level or equivalent in terms of a qualification, and you need to speak English to a certain level. But I think this is a topic that the FBS are going to take up with CIC or Build UK or...
Yeah, well, there's the Ground Forum, which I do sit on. It has links with the Migration Advisory Committee. And so there has been an ongoing dialogue with them, and we've been collecting views on which skills are required. So there's, of course, the skills shortage occupation list, and there's things like geotechnical engineers on there. Unless we go around describing everybody as a geotechnical engineer, which might be a stretch, are we going to have some trouble bringing in those sort of skills that you mentioned for your operative? I think that needs addressing sooner rather than later. We need a collection of particular roles, you know, very carefully defined, to say this needs to go on the list. Of course, we've always had challenges in terms of recruiting people. Before Brexit, I remember we took a graduate from America, and that was a very difficult process to bring him in. And it probably took us 2 or 3 months, several thousand pounds. And of course, you're taking a bit of a punt on somebody as well. You don't know how they're going to work out or not. Probably a bit easier in a global company like you, because you can understand how that individual's going to perform. If they've been working for Keller in the US, you've got trust in their skill set and their attitude and so on, and you can bring them in. But if you don't have that, then are you going to be prepared to put in that investment in bringing them into another country, spending the money and the time as well in recruitment? It's a very difficult decision for businesses to make. And certainly if we can make things easier by, at least within the European Union, trying to open a few more doors for these particular roles, then that is going to help businesses like yours and mine deliver these big projects that we've got coming up. The big one we mentioned before, of course, is HS2. And I'm interested to learn a little bit more about how you're planning to resource that, because I've already seen lots of your eggs on sites. So there's a big one next to the M25, Rickmansworth direction. It's been a little while since I was around there, but certainly last time there was 5 or 6 machines on that site. I assume you've got lots of others coming through as well. I believe that's the case.
Yes, so we have. Been fortunate enough in picking up a number of contracts on High Speed 2. Most of them have been enabling works contracts, trial piling contracts, advanced works contracts and the like. We've just or in the process of agreeing a number of full works contracts as we speak. In terms of resourcing, you know, a lot of people talk about the rigs. You know, have you got the rigs for this? Have you got the rigs for that? Maybe a decade ago, the rigs perhaps were a bit of a bottleneck because, of course, you couldn't rent them as freely as you can today. But I don't believe the rigs are and will be an issue for High Speed 2, regardless of who the geotechnical contractors are. It's more to do with the skilled people who are going to operate those rigs and work in front of them day in, day out. In terms of Keller and our joint venture partners, we have got a number of European people on the project already. They came to the site prior to the 1st of January, so they have applied for permission to remain, so they can continue on with the project in the main. And of course, as you said, if they're of an engineering persuasion, if they've got a degree or something like that, then they are free to come and work in the UK, subject to the immigration rules. We also think that, as I said, given the impact of COVID and also probably more than likely Brexit as well, then it's likely that the sort of general market isn't going to be as busy over the next couple of years as it might have been otherwise. And that will mean that there will be a bit of capacity in the market, and certainly the capacity within Keller UK's traditional markets. So we're able to deflect resource that would have gone into the sort of bread and butter part of the business onto High Speed 2. So we will be all right in terms of resourcing High Speed 2. Whether we then have to do a little bit less work in the standard business, we'll have to wait and see.
I've got a slightly different perspective on that. I think there's some pent-up demand from this period. I think there is still a lot of people that, if we take London, for example, which is obviously the biggest market by geography, there's still a lot of people that are on a good salary that live in shared accommodation that would love to have their own place to live. And so I can see there still being a growth in either the build-to-rent sector or, you know, just new build. Maybe some of that is a migration away from the city, so de-urbanisation. But I do see the domestic housing market really coming back strongly. But, yeah, we'll see. In terms of plant, you spoke about it, fairly easy to bring in plant sent from overseas and hire, cross-hire equipment. I think that the foundation industry is getting closer, maybe enabled by the strength of an organisation like the FPS, but also the different means of communication that we have now, social media and video calls and so on. We all seem to be a bit closer and able to share those resources more effectively. I am a little bit concerned over the emissions regulations. There is a change coming in the next month, which is going to make it more difficult for some of our older machines to work in London. Now, those regulations, they're progressive. They're the way the industry needs to go. But it is going to, I think, create some challenges for businesses in terms of using their equipment in the next few years. If I look at our fleet, we've got, I think the oldest machine we've got is 7 years old. And yet there's still a good number of those machines we would be unable to operate in the lowest emission areas in London. You can get retrofit into the exhaust emissions, but that only takes it so far. So we'll be updating our fleet to address those concerns. But
that's a good thing, isn't it, Steve? I think it falls into companies like yours, Steve, are going to carry on investing, and that's got to be a good thing. Clearly, improving the emissions quality has got to be the right thing to do. And it'll make it harder for those bad businesses, those businesses that don't invest or won't invest, to continue on. And so in terms of sustainability, there's always a bit of push, if you like, from legislation and from customers. And there's always a bit of pull from us wanting to do the right sort of thing. So I really think that that's, as you say, it's progressive and it's definitely heading in the right direction.
In terms of your workload, strong in terms of HS2, that's going to roll out over probably a few years in terms of the UK. What sort of visibility do you have on a typical week, month, in terms of forward workload?
Well, the business around the world generally has about a three-month order book. So most geotechnical contractors are looking ahead about 3 months. And Keller has sales of 2 and a bit billion, and we do something like 6,000 projects a year, which means that the average is about £350,000 as an average project size. So you can see we're doing jobs that might be £20,000 and last a week, and you might do a job that's as much as £200 million and last for 3 years. And trying to plan and organise an organisation to do those extremes and everything in between is part of the challenge. So the order book is always reasonably short term. But that doesn't mean you're turning it through. So that's that can be good news also, because you're not being lumbered with very large lumpy contracts, which makes the company less predictable.
It does create some difficulties in terms of staffing levels. So you win a big project in one area, particularly when it's, you know, you've got to get a local workforce potentially. And we've spoken about the troubles of bringing people from overseas, particularly in a post-Brexit world. You ramp up training and development, and then actually, have we got jobs for those people? And I'm speaking as an industry as much as an individual contractor. Are we going to be able to sustain that employment? So let's take post-HS2. Where do those people go? And I think we've got a responsibility as an industry to make sure that the skills that we're developing in our people are flexible enough that if there is a downturn, that they're able to move on to other types of employment if the geotechnical sector can't be sustained. I know you've got a particular passion and interest for training, and maybe you'd like to explain it a little bit about some of the things that you've been involved with, because I know you've looked a lot at, for instance, degree apprenticeships at Keller, haven't you? But not so much in that sort of specific niche of geotechnics. It's been a broader approach that you've adopted in terms of civil engineering.
Yeah, well, I want to give a bit of a plug for the FBS again. So back in 2016... as part of the Ground Forum, in fact, that you mentioned earlier, we did lobby government over a sort of fairly sustained period to ensure that the loans scheme was available for students who wanted to go and do a second degree. So at that time, you could only get a loan, student loan, for your BSc or BEng or even MEng, because it was one degree. But you couldn't then get a loan if you wanted to go on and do an MSc in geotechnical engineering. So it was really a barrier to people going on to study geotechnical engineering. And, of course, there's no sort of first degree in geotechnics as such. You have to study it as a second degree. So the government did agree back in 2017 that they would widen that out, not just for geotechnical engineering, of course, but for all second degrees. And I think that maintaining that is so important for our sector, because I think that the professional capability of our geotechnical contractors, and we started off talking about Spurwall, but really understanding what's going on technically in the ground is so important for us. And, you know, we want to assist general contractors and consultants and clients alike in early contractor involvement and getting involved in value engineering and being part of that design process, so that our geotechnical knowledge is something that we need to guard and preserve. And I think that having a strong geotechnical engineering base at universities is actually an important strand to that. So I'd like us to see us get behind that, possibly as an industry, if not as a group of employers, whether the FPS could do anything to give that a little bit more oomph. And one of the things, you know, you talk about is maybe if there is a sort of a variability in workload, then could the industry sort of co-sponsor a number of applicants that could go between employers, if that's the way that we had to cater for that?
And yeah, well, we do see some sharing of resources, particularly on the operative front, between some of the larger partner contractors already, and I suppose it's just an extension of that principle. In terms of degrees, there is, of course, the Engineering, Geology and Geotechnics course at Portsmouth University, which has provided a lot of students to the industry in the past, and it is a great course. They have encountered some difficulty in terms of attracting students in over the last few years. So one of the statistics I pulled in from Nick Corr, who's the lead on that course, was there's been a 43% drop in geoscience subjects at university over the last 6 years. And he was linking it. And by the way, there's a great AGS webinar that Nick delivered available. Please take a look. He's linking it to a drop in the amount of students studying geology at A-levels is even linking it to a drop in the oil price. So there was a time in the 70s and 80s, it was the place to go. We were in the North Sea, we were pumping millions or billions of barrels of oil, and there were some great wages, and students were attracted to work in that sector. That's obviously reduced in the UK. Also, it's less fashionable. I'm not sure fashionable is the right word. People are more environmentally sensitive now, and quite rightly so. And when we produce the material for these courses, we've got to do it in a different way. We've got to talk about geothermal energy, about renewable energies. We've got to talk about land use. And Nick gives a really inspiring talk about a move towards a urban geoscience and how that can actually lead to a more diverse industry. Hopefully at some point I'll actually get Nick onto the podcast to discuss that in a little bit more detail. But I do think that would be a way for us to really move on and bring different sorts of skills in that are going to be really useful to our businesses in the future. Returning to the degree apprenticeship. So you've had people do a civil engineering degree at Birmingham. And do you want to just explain for listeners how that would work, how long the course is, how many hours a week you would lose those individuals, and what the feedback's been like? The students must talk to you and tell you what they're getting out of it, I assume.
Yes, so in terms of the degree apprenticeship, this is for civil engineering. There is a degree apprenticeship coming up in Birmingham in September of this year for geotechnical engineering. So you can do your MSc under an apprenticeship.
So that's a level 7, isn't it? It's described as a level 7 degree apprenticeship. Yeah.
But to go back to the civil engineering degree course, the apprenticeship there, there are a number of institutions that are offering that. But essentially, what you will do is you will take 5 years to do a 3-year BEng. So as an apprentice, you're obviously taking longer to do your course, but you're getting the benefit of being paid. And you generally get paid a reasonable sort of graduate, or being quite close to a graduate salary, and you get a car and all that sort of thing. And there are various models for the various degree apprenticeships. Some work on a sort of a day release type scenario where you're leaving sort of 1 day per week, where others are sort of a bit more block release, and some have a combination thereof. For the student or for the apprentice, obviously they miss out on student life to some degree, but they are getting the benefit of an income. They're getting the benefit of sort of work experience from the very get-go. I suppose the downside is you might argue they have to work a bit harder because they're trying to do both a degree and work, you know, at the same time. A lot of the degree apprenticeships, though, are accredited to ICE standards. And so once you've finished it, you've finished sort of your part one of your training scheme as well. So there is that.
Terrific. So you've already got Head Start. I remember back when I was at university, and these are the days when we've still got grants, but I did a sandwich course. So the third year was in industry. And that final year when I came back, it all just meant so much more. I was far more applied. I just got it, and I was a much better student. I think you're getting that from day one of starting a degree apprenticeship. So I'd really encourage people to have a look at that if they've got potential recruits coming in, to see if that's a good way for them to get that sort of technical background, but also industry experience, because then they're then not going to have those big loans that can really be a drag for somebody's financial will be in the future.
Yeah, I'd also say don't forget the graduates. I mean, you also want graduates coming into your organisation as well. I don't think degree apprentices replace graduates completely. I think you're going to need a blend of them. You are going to have to provide quite a bit of mentoring for your degree apprentice as well. So it's not the only answer to a skills gap. I would urge people to make sure they continue to employ the graduates as well. And what I'd like to promote is graduates coming into the industry and then us providing them with the opportunity to do an MSc in geotechnical engineering as an apprenticeship.
Yeah, there's certainly been lots of discussions about those geotechnical degree apprenticeships, and I think they do have merit and support. Be keen to see that one in Birmingham start and get some feedback on the first batch of apprentices. But you're right, there are students that want that university experience, and that will be the route for them, and it quite right, that's available. But then there'll be others that actually they wouldn't have even had the option, just financially it wasn't viable for them, perhaps socially disadvantaged, or perhaps they've got caring responsibilities. It's just not possible to go away to university for 3 or 4 years. And it's a really good way to bring a far greater range of people into the industry. In terms of the skills, I know you wanted to discuss some of the sort of digital and BIM skills that you're employing at Keller and that you see taking the industry forward. To what extent are you seeing BIM within your projects now, Jim?
I think the answer to that is not as much as we'd like. It's back in 2016, I think I'm right in saying, when the UK government said that their departmental spend had to have collaborative level 2 BIM. But I suspect not many geotechnical specialists have been able to fully engage with the process. I think some of that is a reluctance of all of the stakeholders in a project to really embrace BIM going forwards. You know, and there are many aspects to it. I mean, you all know that the FPS has long asked for site investigation, investigation, just to be issued in electronic format, and yet we always get it in PDF form, which is, less use to us. We've had a Excel pile schedule running in the FPS for many years that we've asked people to use as the template for filling in design data, which we could then take into the BIM process. You all know about rig instrumentation and how sophisticated that is. And what we did in Keller, and I'm sure it's not just us, is that we worked with some developers and Autodesk and came up with a process whereby we can take that AGS data, we can take the FPS spreadsheet, we can take the client's BIM model and link them all so that it all auto-populates the BIM model, which then sends that data to the rig computer. And then the rig driver has got all of that information in front of them in real time, and if anybody changes the design in the model, it can then translate to a variation in the geotechnical data. And then as the pile is built, that data is relayed back through your standard rig instrumentation. It might be something like NDT or some other bespoke type instrumentation on the rig. It goes back into the BIM program, so all the stakeholders are watching that being progressed in real time in 3D, so everybody can see how the solution that we're actually building relates to the ground conditions and the structure above. And I think that is a really powerful thing, because all the checks and balances that one needs to do is then being done by all the stakeholders on the project. And also, because all of the data is seen at the same time, it's transparent because it's untouched by human hand. And I think that engenders this collaboration then on site. And people feel part of the same project rather than part of a very sort of prolonged supply chain. So I think many of us are very keen and ready to get on with that. And I think that if the industry is going to make the cultural shift that it keeps talking about in terms of greater collaboration, then I really believe that BIM has a part to play in that, because it does cut across the contractual divides that we set ourselves up on.
Yeah. Well, when we collect all that information and we share it amongst the team, I think we can draw things from it. We try and analyse the amount of concrete we're using in certain conditions of certain diameters and depth piles and so, you know, that can be a really powerful tool. And we can make those continuous little improvements to our business that makes us more efficient and environmentally, you know, it's a really conscious thing to do. So I do see that as being powerful. There's a product Microsoft use, and I think a lot of us are starting to use it in the industry now, Power BI. I'm sure there's other products out there as well, but you can draw so much data out of it really quickly, really user-friendly. Just click on a few different variables, it's all collected there. Needs a little bit of programming behind the scenes, but it can be really useful in terms of managing your business. Bringing it back to where we started, the ICE specification, presumably there is at least some sort of reference to BIM within the specification now.
There is. There's a section of one of the, or paragraph of one of the sections that is related to BIM and how you can then structure a BIM environment, a common data environment, where geotechnics can play its part in that. But also, either in the specification itself or this section C that we call it, these notes for guidance, we actually require the geotechnical contractor to pass up to the client in original form some of the rig instrumentation output. So, you know, we were talking about AGS and the PDFs and all that sort of thing. Sure. Well, generally speaking, the geotechnical community would be PDFing the output from rig instrumentation and then sending that on if the client wants it. The specification actually asks you to send it in its raw format so that they can manipulate it and process it within their own systems. So, yeah, it's very much part of that. What I would really like to see is principal contractors really encouraging their supply chain to use BIM far more than they currently do.
Well, that's very neatly sort of brought it all round, and I think at this point it's appropriate to thank you for giving us such an insight into what's happening in the world of foundations and piling, some of the best practices that are out there, the new techniques. I'm sure our listeners have thoroughly enjoyed listening.
Thank you, Steve. Very much. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you for listening. I've really enjoyed interacting with some of you on social media and through video calls recently. It's great to see the positive impact that our programmes can have on our community. Please do continue to share so that we can help even more people. Also, if you'd like to sponsor a future edition of the podcast, do get in touch. We're really just looking to cover recording costs, so very reasonable rates apply. Until next time, take care.